We'll go on to case 072077, United States versus Reed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Andrew J. McGowan. I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois, and I represent the appellant in this case.
Good morning, Mr. McGowan.
Good morning, Your Honor. Mr. Reed appeals the denial of his motion to suppress the evidence obtained by a consent search and the refusal to give Mr. Reed's theory of defense instruction for innocent touching. During the traffic stop, officers asked Mr. Reed for permission to search 4009 Bonfield. He said, "Nah, that ain't my place. I can't give you permission to search there." The girlfriend, however, was at the traffic stop as well. The officer went to her and asked her for her consent, and she gave that consent. The officers knew that they lived at this area in this house because of a two-month investigation, and prior to the request for consent of Mr. Reed, he had described his association with the house by saying he paid rent, he'd stayed there from time to time. Because Mr. Reed refused to consent and was present with his girlfriend when he did so at the time he refused, the evidence should have been suppressed under Randolph, which only requires that the person refuse consent and that the other person be present.
You say present with his girlfriend. Where was he? Where was he and where was she when he disclaimed residency?
Your Honor, there was a traffic stop. He was either by the car or in the police car, which was, as I understand it, close.
Well, she wasn't with him, though.
Your Honor, she wasn't in the car, but she was there at the stop.
She showed up afterward, I thought.
She showed up while he was being interrogated by the officers.
Right.
Now, she wasn't in the car, so it wasn't like she came out of the car or was in the car. We don't have a snapshot or a videotape of what happened. But my understanding is that she was in the area and was asking for what's going on to the police.
But, Mr. McGowan, isn't it a huge stretch to say that the narrow holding in Randolph should apply here? I mean, how can you say that she showed up at the site of the traffic stop? Her showing up there is analogous to the factual situation in Randolph, where both the consenting and the denying parties were literally at the door speaking with the police officer at the very same time.
Well, there is a factual difference, of course, between Randolph, the facts in Randolph, and the facts in this case. However, my reading of Randolph is not so narrow as the government's. And it really, I do believe it requires that the person, people be together to some extent. It's not like, you know, if he's at the traffic stop and he says no, and then they go to the actual residence. I don't know that that actually fits Randolph. However, the usual rule for consent is that it doesn't matter where you consent to give consent. That's why the policeman asked him at the traffic stop for consent. And there's no case that I know of, and certainly Randolph doesn't really discuss the situation, where the officers have an actual refusal to consent, whether it's at the doorway or not. Now, the facts of Randolph are that they're at the doorway, and I think the court goes out of its way to explain the ruling in terms of the doorway because it's giving a general rule for officers going to doorways and asking for consent. That's where this usually happens. And they may not know the people involved. But the court in Randolph makes it clear it doesn't matter the person's property interest in the place. The owner of the property is just as able to say, no, you can't search this place as a visitor. So the discussion in Randolph, which is pretty broad, does focus on the facts of the case in Randolph and also the more usual situation. But in this case, of course, the officers knew where these people lived. It's not like they went to the doorway and were confronted with somebody they didn't know who said, no, you can't consent, or no, you can't search. In this case, they knew the both people. They investigated them for a couple months. And so when I read the holding in Randolph, which is listed in a couple different places, and says, for instance, we hold that in the circumstances here at issue, a physically present co-occupant's stated refusal to permit entry prevails, rendering the warrantless search unreasonable and invalid as to him, it doesn't talk about the threshold. It just talks about whether the person refused. And again, I just don't know of any cases, unfortunately, where there is a refusal to allow the search. Certainly Randolph involves that, but a situation where the person's not there, or in this case, where they're both relatively present at the same place.
Just out of curiosity, this is obviously hypothetical, but suppose both of them are at the door, and Reed says, same thing, nah, this ain't my place, or whatever it is. You have to talk to my girlfriend. And then she comes up. Now, this isn't what happened, obviously. And she said, well, yeah, go ahead. There's guns upstairs. Instead, you know, he said that, and then they had a warrant out, and so he's gone. And then she deliberates a long time, talks to her sister, calls an attorney, and ultimately they go in. So there's a long, protracted process here, right?
Right.
Yeah. So I'm just saying that if he had said the same thing at the door, which he probably wouldn't have, and she probably wouldn't have. But if you put it in that, you separate them, that's probably would be okay. Where she says, he says, nah, you got to talk to her, it's not my place, and she says, okay.
I think that's right. And actually, that's the distinction I'd like to draw between what he did say. I don't think it was an invitation for him to the police to go look for somebody else and overrule his refusal. He said no.
And he said no, but what?
Well, he said, no, it's not my place.
Yeah.
I can't give you permission to search there. It's legally an incorrect statement. But it doesn't mean that that they can just then go ahead and ask somebody else for permission to search in the face of the actual refusal. Now, I understand that that's one of the arguments that the government has made, that wasn't really refusal enough. But, of course, it is a refusal that the police could not have searched based on what he did say. And it's very similar to the statement in Ellis, where this court characterized it simply as a refusal where the person was at the doorway and said, no, it's not my place, or he said, no, I guess it's not my place.
But in Ellis, that's distinguishable from this case since there was no separate consent in Ellis.
Right. I was just using it as an example of how to view what he did say.
But they didn't go in based on what he said. They went in based on what she said, ultimately.
Well, right.
So obviously, when he said, no, it ain't my place, that doesn't mean then, well, they can go barging in.
Exactly, especially when they know his relationship to the place.
Well, but also they knew her relationship with the place.
True. Just briefly on the statement of the argument for the jury instruction. I think the jury instruction was appropriate statement of law, and I think this is the one published case, where the facts would support an innocent touching defense in a firearm case. There are no cases that I've either found or the government's found where the person actually testified the basis for the fingerprints on the gun and the weapon.
In the ammunition box.
In the ammunition box.
Did you, in fact, argue to the jury that fingerprints alone or accidental touching were insufficient to sustain a conviction?
Your Honor, I was not counsel at trial. I believe that counsel certainly argued that there was insufficient evidence. Of course, the government had a jailhouse informant, but that was the only evidence of anybody that he had the guns at any time at trial. And I believe he did argue that it was insufficient evidence. Unless there are any more questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Sure thing. Thank you, Mr. McGowan. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Jesse Barrett for the United States.
Would you spell your last name?
It's Barrett, B-A-R-R-E-T-T.
Oh, hi, Mr. Barrett.
And I was trial counsel below. I think the Court, in terms of the Randolph issue, is accurately focusing on the differences between this case and Randolph versus Georgia. And the differences actually are quite striking, particularly when looking at the language of Randolph, which refers to them drawing a fine line, refers to the formalism of their decision, refers to the need for the police to have clear guidance, even if the rule is somewhat arbitrary. So we have not only different facts, but also a fairly narrow Randolph decision. Here, Mr. Reed did not give express denial. He simply said, I can't it's not my place. I can't give you consent. Judge Miller did not clearly err in determining that that was not express refusal. It was merely a statement that I can't give you consent. So that's one important difference. The other important difference is that whatever objection or refusal to consent there was did not take place at the threshold. It took place in a parking lot some blocks away from the house. As the panel noted, Mr. Reed was interviewed inside a police car. Sometime during the traffic stop, Ms. Foster, his girlfriend, showed up and was interviewed in a different location. She never actually even came in contact with Mr. Reed at the traffic stop. And perhaps also of some significance, her final consent to the search did not even occur until she got back to the house, at which Mr. Reed had long since been taken off to jail in a police cruiser. It wasn't until she actually got back to the house, talked to her sister, talked to an attorney, that she formally signed the consent to search form. So those are, I think, three very significant differences here between what the Supreme Court faced in Randolph versus Georgia and what this court faces here.
Let's assume that Mr. Reed told the officers he lived at the house on Bonfield, but they couldn't search his home. Knowing that, would the officers be justified in entering the house solely on Ms. Foster's consent?
I think it would probably be a closer case under Randolph, but my reading of Randolph is that they still would have been justified in entering with Ms. Foster's consent because that objection did not take place at the threshold and did not take place in the presence of Ms. Foster.
So if she had not accompanied the officers to the home, in that scenario, it would matter.
Right. Let me make sure I understand the hypothetical. Do you mean if she had consented at the scene of the traffic stop but then not accompanied them back?
Right.
Right. Even in
first hypothetical I gave you, she's actually there on the premises. She consents.
Mm-hmm.
Second is she's not there on the premises. She gives them consent somewhere away from the premises.
I think the cases probably get closer and closer as we move out in the hypotheticals. But I think in both of those hypotheticals, the court has posed, recognizing that it is a formal line, recognizing that it is perhaps a little bit arbitrary. I think that's what the Supreme Court did in Randolph. And it's worth noting that since Randolph came down, pretty much all of the circuits and the district courts that have addressed the case have recognized its formality and required an express denial of consent, something different from it's not my place, something more akin to no, I'm not going to let you search that, and have required that the objection take place at the threshold. So there's... I think the other courts have recognized the rigidity of Randolph, which we're arguing for here. And that's both the Seventh Circuit and other courts. As to the jury instruction issue, while it is, of course, not dispositive, I think it is worth noting that, as far as we know, no federal court anywhere has ever approved the accidental touching instruction that Mr. Reed seeks here. That is worth, I think, keeping in mind as we do the analysis. And the cases upon which he relies to make that argument have been disfavored by the Seventh Circuit. So the support for that argument is fairly weak in terms of the case law. But even when looking at this case, first of all, there is a possession instruction which makes clear what knowing possession is and what knowing possession isn't. What constructive possession is and what constructive possession isn't, the standard Seventh Circuit pattern instruction. And then the facts of the case are not only that Mr. Reed's prints were found on the gun, but also that they were found on the ammunition box, which was in an entirely different location than the gun, and the ammunition in the box matched the ammunition in the gun. So it's not the weak case that defense would have it would like it to be. It's fingerprints on gun and ammunition box in two different locations some months after the time when Mr. Reed says that he had his accidental touching. And he, in fact, never was able to, even attempted to rebut that argument in his closing. And as to the court's question about whether there was an argument that this was accidental touching, my recollection of defense counsel's argument at trial was that there was indisputably a touching by Mr. Reed, but that that touching wasn't enough to constitute knowing possession. If the court has no questions, I think that's all I have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
How much time does Mr. McGowan have?
1 minute.
Okay.
Just briefly, Your Honors. The testimony Mr. Terry gave at trial was that the box of ammunition and the gun were in a bag at the same time when he touched them. That's not how they were found when the search was done. It was at a different house. So the other thing is that the possession instruction and the knowing instruction I don't think really quite covers the situation here. The word knowingly means that the defendant realized that he was what he was doing and was aware of the nature of his conduct. I'm concerned when I see that instruction that the jury could conclude, even if they just believed Mr. Reed as opposed to the rest of the jailhouse informant, for instance, that if he had touched the gun and realized that it was a gun as he was touching it, that would be sufficient. Unless there are any questions.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement. We're going to go on to...